And, of course, it then says that those who look at you, your opponents, will not have an occasion to say evil things of you because of your behavior. And then it goes one step further to bond servants. Bond servants, in our modern context, might be as we are employees, to have our behavior exemplary. And you know, I go back to when my mother worked for the telephone company years and years ago and was a member of Commercial Workers of America because the job required her to do that. And CWA went on strike a few times while she was there. My mom was a wonderful believer in Jesus Christ and really, really struggled with the idea that she had the right to do that to an employer. And she got put between a rock and a hard place. And to see my mother picketing would have been a real unusual thing because she understood that she had an obligation to her employer. But what struck me about this in the Sound Church is that there's this relationship that we build. You know, we could go through and analyze each of these, and actually that's a great sermon. But what I'm really interested in here in this context is the relationships that are built between all the generations, and not just between generations, but across families and into communities, and how important it is that we have these kinds of relationships in our churches as we want to be a sound church. And I trust from what I've heard from Paul that you have that kind of situation here in your church. We go to an evangelical free church in St. Paul, which is now at about 1,000 people on a Sunday. I started going there when I was 4 months old, so I've been there a while. And you know what? I don't know everybody anymore. This is what happens when you get to be these large churches. We always were a church of about 250 as I grew up, and you pretty much knew everybody, and everybody was related to everybody anyway. So it gets a little harder as you grow in size, but it's very, very important then that you have those relationships. But the scripture points us toward a reason for this. It isn't just to have the relationships so that you can have fellowship one with another. There is a reason for this. If you look in verse 14, Jesus Christ gave himself for us, it says, and why? To redeem us from every lawless deed. But this is the object, to purify for himself, and the New King James says for his own special people. I like the Old King James where it says his peculiar people. I'm proud to be a peculiar person, as the scripture says that I am called to be peculiar, different from the society, maybe even viewed as somewhat weird. I'm proud of my weirdness, in other words. No, I'm not. No, I'm not proud. What am I? I'm glad. I'm very humble about my pride. But here we are to purify himself for himself, his own special people. And this is the thing I wanted to focus on here and spend a little time with. In fact, this is going to be the link, if you will, into the lesson on where we are in healthcare. And it's pretty interesting to me how we've developed as a culture. I teach a high school government class called American Government for Real. And I spend the first half of the semester teaching how American government is supposed to work. And I spend the second half of the semester talking about how it really works. And they're almost counter to each other. You know, it isn't that our founders were perfect, but they did create a system that works quite differently than the one that we have today. And so we want to hang on to, I don't know why I put that in there, something hit it in my mind here, but we want to build on good things and take those into the community. In Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, we know it says, by grace you've been saved through faith, not of works that any man should hope. But we oftentimes leave out verse 10, which talks about us being his workmanship and being created in Christ Jesus for good works. And so we're very often willing to accept this great gift of salvation and claim it by faith, which we need to be doing, but we forget verse 10. And we don't talk about the good works. And there's a reason for that, I think. One of those good works we find in Galatians 2:10. I have the advantage of having done this last night. And that's where Paul was confronting the disciples, the apostles, and they made, you know, peace with each other, and they sent him out to teach to the Gentiles. And he very specifically says that they urged him to remember the poor. My grandfather, Racer, was a pastor, came to St. Paul in 1915 when my dad was a year old, and was the superintendent of the Union Gospel Mission, or assistant superintendent, for 35 years and chaplain there. One of my early childhood experiences was sitting in a Tuesday night service where my dad was leading the singing and having a man die next to me because he was inebriated. But that was my grandfather's heart, to serve those people who were down and out. When I grew older, I found that I was disgusted with those people. And it took me a while to realize my own shame, that this is who Jesus Christ gave his life for. And for those who are less fortunate than we Americans and so forth. Now we look at Matthew 25, 35. Governor Al Quie in the state of Minnesota, he was a congressman for 20 years, and then he ran for governor. This is actually my first political campaign in 1978, where I got involved in elective politics. And my father had told me that Governor Quie, or Congressman Quie, was a wonderful, godly man, and that he deserved to be governor of the state. And I got to know Al Quie quite well. Actually, he wrote the foreword to our second book about Tom Byrd, called In the Shadow of Joseph. And I remember this because Governor Quie now comes and talks to my students about why he is no longer for the death penalty. And I'm not going to get into that discussion with you. But this wonderful grand man who is now 86 years old and comes and ministers to my students, which I'm very proud of, because I love him so much, and he's got so much wisdom. He talks about the fact that God gives life to all who ask. And so his motivation came from this passage. And you know, as we go through it, which one it will be. Jesus Christ said at that time when he judges, he looked on the people and he said, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me water. I was a stranger and you showed hospitality. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously. I was naked. And I call that ragged clothes here, because I don't know if he meant literally naked. And you gave me clothing. I was sick and you visited. And I think that meant more than just saying, hi, I'm here. Maybe I brought a meal. I sat down and talked with you. You were in prison, or I was in prison, and you went to minister to those in prison. This is the one that stopped Al Quie in his moment in the early 70s. When he went and volunteered to serve out the rest of Chuck Colson's prison term because he began to be convicted about how we ignore people in prison. In my experience with Tom Byrd, I managed to go to Lansing Correctional Facility a dozen times and mingle with the inmates. It's rather an interesting experience. I had another day where I went to a prison ministry, actually a Christian prison inside a prison, and spent the whole day mingling with 200 inmates. And I met the head of their seminary, who was a double murderer. And, you know, it's rather unique to have those experiences, but to see the way that Jesus Christ changed their life. But my whole point of looking at this is, for instance, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me water. You gave me hospitality. You gave me clothing. And it occurred to me that none of those were a government agency, that these were agents of Jesus Christ doing good works, the kinds of things that he talked about us being created for, pointing toward good works. That we have an obligation as a Christian church, as a Christian family, as a so-called Christian nation, to care for those who are less fortunate. But never, never does it talk about in the scriptures that this is an obligation of our government. Now, in those days, governments didn't do those things. But I must tell you that the first hospital was started by a woman because of spiritual conviction, and set up a hospital at the church. And it was very common in that era, and this is in the 300s and 400s and 500s, for the churches to have hospitals to care for those who couldn't care for themselves. That's the kind of thing I think that we're looking at in this sort of ministry, people taking care of people who are in distress. The church I grew up in, Evangelical Free Church, was I always said we were sort of like tolerant Baptists, you know, fundamentalist Baptists who sometimes can get a little legalistic. We were sort of like, you know, tolerant fundamentalist Baptists. We were a little bit tolerant of aberrant behavior. But now we've redefined aberrant, so, you know, we're tolerant of lots of things, right? But there was a fear of the social gospel, and I think for good reason. I think that often the church was focused more on the ministry outside the church. It wasn't ministering necessarily to people inside the church, and I don't know all that history. But I do know that they were somewhat afraid of being identified as ministers of the social gospel. And so maybe the pendulum swung a little bit too far, which is common. And they had an avoidance, not just a disinterest or apathy, but they had an avoidance of political entanglements, very, very much afraid that to bring the political into the church would damage the church. And perhaps it had something to do with what was going on in our court system at the time, which I'll show you a little bit about. Now, good families in those days cared for each other. The extended family was a huge thing. We were taught to care for grandma and grandpa and mom and dad and very close families. But not necessarily those other families. Those other families, we tended to give up our service to them and let the government more and more begin to take care of them. But the rationalization was, that's what government should do. You know, as long as I pay my taxes, I've satisfied my obligation. And you'll hear among what we might call the very liberal politicians today that claim Jesus Christ, that's part of their thing, you know, is to say we're admonished to care for others. And that's why we create this program for insurance for young children, for instance, or food programs or, you know, cards for this and cards for that. We had this aversion to care for others personally, and we hired it out. I used to own service master businesses, and I cleaned the church for many years. Now, this is a problem. Paul looked at my glasses today, and he just had to clean them. When I was in the cleaning business, you didn't want me in your house, believe me. I was looking. I couldn't help it. And when I went to church, and we had the janitor contract there, I always saw dust balls. And it was terrible, and I couldn't concentrate in worship. I was worried about, you know, cobwebs and dust balls and things. So I gave up the contract, and the church asked me to write a comprehensive document about how they could manage the building better. And you know what I discovered? Our church had hired out just about everything. By that time, there was very few things that the body itself did, you know, to take care of the physical plant. We were so accustomed to hiring, and I think this was true in our obligations. The thing about government, especially progressive government, as it begins to grow more and more and progress more and more, is that it will always fill a void. Our government will not allow people to die on the street. They won't do it. They will create a program and tax other people to fund it and lose a lot of money in the bureaucracy. But they won't let it happen. They will fill the void one way or another. And so we start to give up more and more of our personal social responsibility to a larger organization that we call the government. That brings us to healthcare. And there is a connection here. Now, I'm going to tell you that I'm working on a doctorate, and I want to write my dissertation on faith and how it ought to inform the way we consume healthcare. And this is a really, really tough thing, as you'll see as we go through. We're told that there's a healthcare crisis in the United States, and that became healthcare reform. Now, I've been working on this almost 6 years, so this crisis has been ongoing for actually 55 years, or 50 years, but And then it turned into health insurance reform. You look at this question, you know, oh, Paul, why isn't this going? I didn't even know it. Here, I think that you are all watching this. I didn't even turn around to look. Huh? Goodness. Yeah, that's really weird. I thought you were all watching this thing with me. Okay, now you can, right? I hope you've been following. There you go. It'll warm up. Oh, my. Am I embarrassed? You've all been exposed to this now for many, many months and years, this whole argument. You know, which of these was the most, you know, a concern in our crisis, that we had a quality problem or access to health care, everybody should have access, and, or was it the cost of care, or was it the uninsured, or was it, you know, health care spending? Which one was the one that predominated? And the federal government decided that the most important one was the uninsured. Now, if you think about what we just discussed, you can understand that the government will fill a void. And if people don't have insurance, despite the fact that it doesn't increase access to health care, because you have a limited supply and you're adding more people, and that's another whole discussion, the fact is that the government doesn't want people uninsured, and so it fills a void. And it assumes that there's a problem there, a social problem that it must solve. In 1776, our founders passed, of course, the Declaration of Independence, which I just love. When I teach my lesson on the Declaration, it's really like a sermon. And I've written a little book on it called America's Creed, which is actually out there. And if you study the Declaration, you'll realize that it expressed the religious beliefs of the founders. As you dig into it, you find so many references to their Christian faith and their theology. But the central declaration was this one, that we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, but among these are life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and health care. No, I just threw that in. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we just take a moment to talk about human life and what this means. Oh, boy, there it went again. Well, this is what we were learning, right, Paul? It's cooling off. The filter's out of there. We'll see what happens. If you can see this beautiful picture right now that I'm looking at, it says human life from conception to death by natural causes. And that this is the basis of our conviction about human life and the conviction that the founders had. In fact, when it says we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, or that we were all created equal, you can't get to equality without going through the Creator. The Creator is the preeminent creator of equality and a preeminent creator of these unalienable rights. We'll see if that comes back on. And so you're missing the wonderful picture of my granddaughter there. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You are sorry. She's beautiful. I believe it was George Washington, but so many of the founders talked like this. They said our form of government is fit only for moral people. Our form of government, a republic, in which there's independent freedom, in which there's liberty and life and the pursuit of happiness, is fit only for moral people. And they meant very, very specifically at that time a Protestant Christian ethic. And, you know, we don't have time to go into that deeply. The Constitution in the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion, and it goes on to talk about the free exercise thereof. Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion. The founders had a clear-cut understanding of what that meant. In 1947, there was a Supreme Court decision called Everson versus USA. This is a central decision which you're dealing with today, the remnants of. The Everson decision, in that decision, this is what the Supreme Court of the United States said. We can't find anywhere in the founding literature what it meant to not prohibit or make no law regarding the establishment of religion. We don't understand what the founders meant. It's unbelievable, because all they had to do is go back and read the founding documents. It would have been very clear. And they subtly changed the definition of the First Amendment. And if you think this through, you'll understand a lot of what's happened in our country to this. Instead of "Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion," it is now interpreted as "Congress shall make no law regarding the encouragement of religion." From establishment to encouragement. Establishment meant simply there was no national creed, no national church. All churches could flourish. Encouragement of religion is a totally different ballgame. It means that Judge Roy Moore is not allowed to put the Ten Commandments behind his bench in Alabama, because that would be encouraging religion. Despite the fact that in Washington, D.C., above the Supreme Court, it's chiseled in the walls. This is that kind of contradiction that is so common in the Supreme Court decisions. If you follow Everson to the next decision and the precedents it set all the way through Roe v. Wade up to Casey, you will see that track that the court got off base because they don't understand, or they refuse to understand, what this document really said. This was critical, and it's critical to our discussion. Proverbs 1:7, one of my favorite verses, says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." When Judge Blackmun walked the halls of Mayo Clinic to come up with this ridiculous Roe v. Wade decision, where he found emanations and penumbras in the law that don't exist, and somehow rationalized that a woman had a legal right to abort her child, he was way off base. He was ignoring the fear of the Lord. Oh boy, this is really an issue now, Paul. Why isn't this thing relaxing? Y'all want to come up and look at my little computer here? I'm going to really have to be descriptive, aren't I? Let me get to one small aspect of healthcare reform, and this is why I wanted to bring this to you. The healthcare law and the stimulus law provided $1.1 billion for comparative effectiveness research. And I might actually be able to use this. We'll see. Comparative effectiveness research is the idea of the government deciding which healthcare procedures work and which ones don't, and which work better and which ones don't. And that always requires a value judgment. And value judgments are moral issues and ethical issues that often fall into the purview of the church, not the government. And you'll see why this is so critical. Praise God it came on at the right time, right? The value of human life is the center of the whole controversy about health care. And I'm going to show you a chart. This chart was actually part of a study done by Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He's the brother of Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff for President Obama. This comes from an article in The Lancet just about a year ago, in which they explored limited resources to care for people in the healthcare system. And their idea is that there is only so much wealth to go around, and we have to make a value judgment of who's worth saving. And if you look at that curve on the far left end, and this is especially now with Titus, we need to think about this. Notice the value. This is in dollars, a value that we ought to invest in human life in order to best use our limited healthcare dollars. And what they're saying is that infants up to a certain age have very little financial value, that we ought not to invest in those little babies that are struggling because they cost too much. And in fact, throughout life, they're really going to cost. That's what they're telling us. Now, on the other end, I'm 63 now. You'll see where I fit on that grade, and some of you beyond about 57 or 58. What they're saying is, if you have a serious or chronic illness, we ought not to be investing in that. We should let nature take its course. And we certainly don't want to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions in you. That comes from the United Kingdom studies, which I don't have time to go into. But you'll see, this is the mindset, and we should focus our healthcare dollars on roughly from about age 5 or 6 through about 40 and 45, and that's where all the money ought to go. And we come right up against technology here, don't we? You all have seen this picture, I bet.
where the doctor was going to do surgery and this little hand reached right out of the belly and grabbed his finger. Those who favor aborting little babies don't like this picture because they talk about this as being just a tissue mass. Tissue masses don't reach out and grab. This is Ramiza Raman. She's the smallest baby ever saved, that's on record anyway, that we know of. Ramiza was 8.6 ounces when she was born, the size of a water bottle. Her big sister was 1 pound 2 ounces. And they both went home healthy. About 3 months later, she was 5.5 pounds when she went home. Do you have any concept of how much money that costs to do that? I don't know the price, but I know when I ask that question in a crowd of insurance people, they'll say millions. Millions of dollars to save Ramiza Raman. We save more tiny babies than any place in the world. If we let the baby be born, we do, not always. I mean, there's a problem in Illinois with the law that President Obama wouldn't sign when he was a senator and actually campaigned against. But that's quite a thing. That's a commitment that we made to these little children. This is Bethany Pearson. Oop, got there a little fast. At age 16, she and her sister and a friend were driving in a car and got T-boned by a pickup truck. Her sister Hannah died immediately in the crash, and they rushed Bethany to the hospital and called her mother and father and said, "You need to come to the hospital and say goodbye to your daughter." Now, you realize they had just lost a daughter the same night. And I cannot imagine the tragedy. I can as a father. Fathers and mothers kind of live in fear that they're going to get a call like this sometime. It's pretty scary. And maybe you all have experienced that yourself. But they said, come and say goodbye to Bethany. Well, this is Bethany a year and a half later. She's now, actually, she's 21. She just started college. And she won a beauty pageant last year. She's a gorgeous, gorgeous girl, except for this little droop in her eye that she'll never get rid of because of the brain damage that she had. She has some problems learning. She needs help. But you would never know it talking to her. Now, Bethany, the reason I know her story so well is that she was one of my students in my government class. And I probably say I have trained 500 minds full of mush to be right-wing extremists. But Bethany was one of my students. This is what the U.S. healthcare system does. She is a tremendous advocate for the U.S. healthcare system. Actually, has gone out and raised money for Gillette Children's Hospital in excess of $5 million to help pay them back. Now, as a result of these kinds of things that we do, the United States spent about $2.5 trillion on health care in 2009. That's more than the gross domestic product of any other nation in the world except Japan. We spend more on health care than they actually generate in income or revenue. So the question is, do we quit providing these kinds of life-saving procedures? And how are we going to ensure that we can afford care unless we start making those value decisions that some people don't deserve to live and other people do? Now, a great deal of this could be reduced if government stepped in. Well, that's the answer that we got this spring, and I'm going to draw a line directly to us in this. Just for fun, you need to see the new CEOs of healthcare in the United States. This is a simplified drawing. Newt Gingrich has one that's so big I can't get it on my slide. But this is a very, very complicated system that's been put together with 159 boards and commissions and grant-making authorities. The Secretary of Health and Human Services now is the effective head of health care in the United States. Her title appears at least 3,000 times in the health care bill. It's so insidious in many ways that they are even going to micromanage the menus. When you start going to McDonald's, you're now going to see on the menu at some point in the future language that the Secretary of Health and Human Services in Washington, D.C. has demanded be put on that menu so you can know the fat content and how bad it is for you. It's kind of like the warning labels on cigarettes that everybody ignored. But we don't have time for me to read this, but it's so much micromanagement because the people obviously cannot be trusted to take care of themselves. Now, here's the problem. The big emphasis is on preventive health care. The reason it's on preventive health care is because there's a concept out there that if you take care of yourself so you'll never get sick, you'll never die. No, that's not what they say. I did hear a doctor once say if we focus on preventive health care and we're so good at it, someday someone's going to show up in the hospital and die of nothing. You know, the fact of the matter is if you take good care of yourself, you'll live a healthier life. But at some point, I mean, and it's not even guaranteed, because you could have a car accident or develop a cancer or something else. But you'll live a healthier life, and the chances are health care spending will go down. And preventive health care is very cheap, by the way, compared to corrective health care. It costs very little to have a shot. It costs a lot of money to have an MRI and several MRIs. So if we can keep you healthier, that's a good thing. But it isn't what the healthcare system is designed to do. The system's designed to fix you when you get sick, kind of like an auto body repair shop. So if you want real preventive health care, the government can't do that for you. You have to become healthier. And here is one of those dilemmas that we have in the church. And I'm not proud to say I let this happen again. This is unhealthy. I shouldn't look like this. You know, I look a little bit like that guy. That's not me. But I could look like that. And I'm working on my weight again because I know that 70% of health care expenses come from lifestyle issues. Now, we look back at all those characteristics of the believer who has a balanced life, a sober life, and we say, how did we get like this? You know, obviously, I don't have a balanced life. Something's out of balance, and I need to bring that back into balance. And, of course, in the modern era, we have all these helps, like the fitness club with the escalator. We do want to make things easy on ourselves. And so we look at ourselves and we say, what is real preventive care? And I say it's this. It's things like my weight. I've got to get my weight under control. I need some exercise in my day. I've got to watch my diet. I've got to make sure not only that I'm eating less stuff, but I'm eating the right stuff. Give up tobacco. I gave it up 30 and almost 31 years ago now. Sleep is a good idea. I'm a little short on this right now. low stress. Now, this is the one I really struggle with. I had a stress attack 2 years ago, and I never realized how serious it was. The pressure I put on myself to perform was immense. And I ended up in an ambulance. It cost $1,594 for me to go to the hospital. That's one reason we spend a lot on health care. I'm working on my stress. Family is extremely important. You find healthier people in intact families and intact churches, I'm sure. And, of course, for us, the spiritual element is extremely important. In fact, if you really want a balanced preventive health care system, let's start where it really starts, because that is the beginning of a healthy life. Jesus Christ as the center of your life is the beginning of a healthy life. As you fear God and you listen to His instruction and you live by His precepts and you take care of the temple of God, and that's the motivation, that's the kind of message that would benefit the entire country, which, by the way, brings us back to the beginning. Our country is only fit for moral people. Our government is only fit for moral people. And when we give up that mantle of moral leadership, the community breaks down. And so what we're looking for is a healthy nation of free people. And that starts with the cross and people together, coming together, healthy people and healthy families bonding together. I'm very, very grateful to hear the testimony Paul has given me of your church. It sounds like you're a supporting body. That isn't true, unfortunately, in many places. I went to one church, a mega church. I won't say the name, but it's in Illinois. It has something like a willow associated with it. Okay, well, that's all right. I don't need it now. And I felt like I was at some sort of performance, and I couldn't figure out where the worship was, you know. Even though there's 22,000 people worshiping or attending on a Sunday, I'm not sure that they have created that sense of community, healthy churches with sound doctrine that perform good works. If you were looking right now, then you would see the extension of this, which is healthy communities. healthy churches, healthy families extend out to healthy communities that extend out to healthy government.
The last photo there would have been the picture of the Minnesota State Capitol. Proverbs 29:2 says, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. I'm not making a political comment there. Honestly, I'm not. I don't mean to imply that. But when we have people in charge of our lives from a government that no longer believes that we can care for ourselves, why? Because we have abdicated in many ways our responsibilities to care for ourselves and given it up to a government because it's much easier for us to let someone else take care of it. That's the kind of rulership we get. And we do find that politics is dirty. We do find that it's evil. We do find that many dirty, evil people participate in it. And I'm not looking at one position. I'm looking at Congress. I'm looking at legislators. I'm looking at governors. And you see in every level of government this kind of breakdown in moral quality. Praise God, there's an awful lot of people who understand the gospel and have accepted the gospel into their life who are running for office these days, and that's an interesting and awesome development for us. So here, if I could wrap it up, as a nation of free people fit only for moral people, we understand this. In our system of government, we're the kings. And when we look at Romans 13 and the duties that we have toward government, we're essentially talking about the duties we have as kings. So as rulers, partial rulers of our country, who elect people to represent us at Congress, they're not the rulers, we are. There's four branches of government, you know. And if I ask you this question, which I do all of my students at the beginning of the year, what are they? They say executive, judicial, legislative. What's the fourth? Well, it happens to be the first three words of the Constitution, we the people. And according to the scriptures, we're to honor the king, and we're the kings. So we have this obligation that comes back on us as a community of believers as we started in Titus and looked at this requirement that we reach out and do good works. So we've been saved for that purpose here on earth to be a peculiar people zealous of good works. When we abdicate that throne as rulers, someone will step in. And I submit to you that that's the moral dilemma that we're in terms of trying to solve even this huge problem, the healthcare dilemma. My wife told me many, many times, and she's heard me give my public talk on healthcare reform, that I need 3 hours to do it. I wouldn't just show you that graph. I would show you the entire picture. And I've chosen one piece. And here's what I want you to do and help me to do over the next few years. Just try to understand how we're going to react to this admonition to care for our own and to use resources wisely to be good stewards. And maybe just talking about my dad at the end of his life. My mother had cancer. She had gastric cancer. We brought her home to our house with my dad. We have a duplex and a walkout apartment down there. It's very nice. And we cared for Mom in her last days, right up till about 3 days before she died. And then my dad lived in the apartment for 5 years. And it was awesome to have Grandpa there, you know, and eat meals with our kids and that sort of thing. This is kind of like families were supposed to work in the old days. Not every family can. And one day my dad, I found him on the floor. He had had a stroke, massive stroke. And 4 days later, and I think I shared this with you, Paul, I was faced with a moral dilemma. My father, for all intents and purposes, was no longer there. And he needed a feeding tube. And I was part of that whole debate, you know, withholding nourishment. And I looked at this as a believer, as a man who dearly loves his father, and understood that I could put him through more pain and suffering and keep him alive another couple weeks. And it would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. I didn't make a financial decision. I made a decision that God had already placed his mark on my father, and he was going home. And we did not insert the tube. That was very hard for me to do. I held my father's hand at 4:23 in the morning the following Monday when he entered the kingdom of God. It was an incredible experience. So there's the moral dilemma. What are we going to do with our own loved ones? I say I don't want to live in a nation that it would say Titus has no value. I want to do everything for Titus that I can. What do we do at the other end of life? You know, are we so jealous for mom and dad's estate that we try to get rid of them, you know, early? What do we do about the fact that we've already spent our unborn children's money on a health care program we can't afford called Medicare? $37 trillion we owe right now that we can't pay. That's immoral. These are the questions I want to explore. How do we deal with these things as a Christian nation, as a Christian body? And how do we then use that maybe as a springboard to lead others into a relationship with Jesus Christ? I really had hoped that we could have some dialogue, but I got going. God bless you all. I'm going to be around. Right? Right. And it says right here it's 10:32 and a half. So Pastor City has a real small clock. I have to have a big one or I won't see it. What do we do now, Paul?